You're listening to WCOM LP Chapel Hill, and coming up in just a second will be Claudio Speakeasy and Radio Theater. Listen up a little. Claudio's over at the front door, opening it up, making sure the sidewalk is swept and the blinds are up for his speakeasy and...
What?
Absolutely. When you own the place, you've got to go out and clean it up. And here he is now at the mic to welcome our guests. Good morning, Claudio.
Good morning, Audrey. That's Audrey Layden of Carborough Bookbeat and also the co-host on this theater, drama, comedy with me. Very happy to have her on board. Today I have a really unique guest and friend by the name of Michael Corbett. My favorite thing about him is that he's also a sailor. And we've got Alex Weiss that just sort of dropped in to hang out. We're going to try and do lunch or something afterwards. But the aim today is to get into the life of Michael Corbett once I've made a few announcements. And first of all, I've got to recognize the good old historic Carolina Theatre of Durham, the primary sponsor of Claudio Speakeasy and Radio Theatre. I've got to get used to announcing it that way. So big thanks to the Carolina Theatre of Durham, and also I'm being shown something here.
Yes, we don't want to forget that Claudio is going to be the featured artist at the Cotton Company in historic Wake Forest. He'll be staging recitals of his own writings along with exhibiting his artwork. The Cotton Company is a place where artists can work and sell their wares, and if you want to know more about it, you go to thecottoncompany.net.
Absolutely, or you can also go to claudioarts.com. Can somebody open the door? I think we have somebody outside. I have no idea who that person is, but we're just acknowledging everybody that comes by this morning. I do want to make special mention to everybody listening this morning that since we are doing this new, I want to call it Homeland Security deal now, I don't know if the people realize out there that this is a primary opportunity for nudist colonies. Since we're going to go through these, what do you call it, these x-rays that are going to show you nude to some CIA perv sitting in some closet watching a monitor screen, you might as well just sort of enter the airport and disrobe on your way to that x-ray machine and take some of the spontaneity out of it for the guy watching you on the monitor.
Oh, but the poor other people all standing around that have to view this.
Just go on in and get nude. This will also scare the terrorists, so it has a double meaning.
I'm sure
the one
would.
Thing, the one reason these people are so frustrated is because they never see anybody naked. So, you know, I'm just trying to put some thoughts together here. But you might want to consider disrobing for Obama once you enter the airports. And I shall try and behave now.
Try. Just try.
Try, yes. I also quickly want to mention that Carolina Theater related, on the 14th, we have the Smithereens coming up. On the 22nd, and I'm actually stage managing this one, we have the comedian Stephen Wright, one of my absolute favorite comedians. And also in June, we're going to have Al Jarreau and the Duke Trio. So those are a few things to look out for at the Carolina Theatre of Durham, and of course you can always go to their website. And now I'm going to turn the microphone over to my friend, and I actually am going to give him a little bit of an introduction. Michael Corbett has worked on more than 1,000 television commercials, probably more by now, and dozens of feature films. He presently serves as the director of the Piedmont Community College Film and Video Production Technology Program in Yanceyville, North Carolina. Boy, that's a long one. He has an extensive history of awards and grants in his field of endeavor, along with a fascinating life, and that's what I want to take the lid off today. So, Michael, welcome to the studio, and please take it from there. The mic is yours.
Claudio, thank you so much for having me here today.
Absolute pleasure.
It was such a pleasure to meet you and work with you on the music video for the Rusty Bucket Kids Club, and then subsequently the pilot episode. So that's kind of our nexus. But one of the things I discovered about you early in our, I think the first day we met, was that we had a common connection to Africa.
And yes, indeed.
I had the privilege, I love to say it this way, I had the privilege of photographing, and when I say photographing, to me, I'm what in the Hollywood industry we call a cameraman, which is really our sort of self-depreciating way to say that we're a director of photography or a cinematographer or whatever. But I had the privilege of...
The folks that put the picture up that we look at.
There you go. I had the privilege of photographing Ian Smith, signing the documents, and turning over the government of what was then Rhodesia to Abel Muzorewa, the leader of the interim government. And it was, you know, even today, it gives me chills.
That blew my mind when you told me about it, and that's when I knew I had to have you on the radio. But yeah, please.
It was just the story. That I was only there for 6 weeks, but what happened, what occurred to me personally, anyway, in those 6 weeks is obviously something I'll never forget. It was a really terrific experience.
No doubt about it. I'd appreciate you going into it to some degree. If you'd like to sort of expose a bit of that. And I want to let everybody know that the mics are open so anyone can have their say.
Well, the interesting thing to me is for my film students, I'm always talking to them about networking. And as a professional filmmaker, you succeed in your career. Most of the time, most of the jobs you do, you're there because someone else recommended you for that job.
Yeah.
Not because you sent somebody a resume or you ran an ad in a magazine or something like that. It's because somebody who has worked with you recommended you for a job. And that was exactly how I ended up on an airplane on my way to Rhodesia from Tulsa, Oklahoma, where I lived.
Incredible.
At the time. I had worked with a gentleman who had met a producer on an airplane flying across the Atlantic. And he, my friend, had just come from Rhodesia and was telling him all about what was going on there. And the producer just happened to be one of the producers of the documentary film that was made by NBC on the Watts riots in the 60s.
Yes, okay.
So he thought, wow, what a great story. And fast forward 2 years later, here's my friend in Africa, and here's the producer in Africa, and they're working on this documentary about Rhodesia. No one knew with any certainty, anyway, that the interim government was going to form in that time period.
Mm-hmm.
But it became obvious that they needed another crew member, somebody that could do camera, et cetera. And I had worked with my friend on some things out of the country, so they knew I had a passport and so on. So I ended up getting this phone call on Sunday morning, and back then all the phone calls weren't fiber optic cables running under the ocean. They were bouncing
right
off of satellites, so everything echoed, and your voice was...
Satellites and rooftops, yeah.
Yeah, your voice was 2 or 3 seconds behind, and you'd hear all this. But anyway, it's like, the producer, Terry Law, says, "Michael, what are you doing?" And I said, "Well, it's Sunday morning. I just woke up." He says, "Well, you want to come to Africa?" And it's like,
"Yes, please."
I said, "Well, I can have my bag packed in about an hour." You know, he said, "Well, you don't need to go quite that."
Spoken like a true sea dog.
And so anyway, when I first arrived there, I had to bring some equipment with me. I had to bring in a sound recorder because they couldn't find one appropriate for what they wanted to do locally. And so I went through a big deal with customs trying to, you know, get that through. And so I had been prepped for the whole thing. And so finally, when, you know, I seemed to be countering a lot of resistance, I started name dropping. I said, "Well, our liaison for this documentary film is Alex Smith." And I didn't have to identify that Alex Smith was Ian Smith's son.
All right.
The immigration person knew that. I think they knew I was coming. They were just putting me through their standard kind of drill and everything.
Probably especially since you were working with that kind of company.
Right. So anyway, once I get through all that and I've gathered my luggage, and I didn't take a great deal. It was a rather hurried packing. tried to make sure I had plenty of warm clothes because at that time it was called Salisbury, Rhodesia. Today it's Harare, Zimbabwe.
Right.
It's a mile high city. It's 5,000 feet above sea level. It's actually closer to 6,000 feet. So I wanted to make sure that I had plenty of warm clothes because
yes,
I knew it would be cooler, et cetera. But there was nobody there to meet me. But being a filmmaker and a kind of a resourceful, you know, a person, it's like, okay, I found a trolley into town, a ride into town, you know, paid a few dollars for it, had to exchange some...
What, no rickshaw boy?
Had to exchange a few dollars, which was an interesting experience in the airport. And there wasn't wasn't that many... people there. It wasn't
they make you exchange a certain amount when you came in? They say, okay, you have to,
No, I just wanted to make sure I'd be able to pay. This was like, you know, totally, I was like on new ground at almost every step. So
my experience was that traveler's checks always worked wherever you went.
Right. Well, I think I had left Tulsa with less than $100 in cash.
So I
wasn't really carrying a lot of money.
You were just ready for another adventure.
That's right. I had a $5,000 tape recorder with me, but you know, it wasn't mine. But anyway, my ride into town, it's like I'm looking around out the window of the bus, and it just looked like West Texas. I mean, I grew up in Texas, you know. I mean, it was kind of semi-arid, desert-like, and there was a pizza place, and there was a Chinese food place, and about the only thing I noticed that was different is they drove on the wrong side of the road. There were a few more black faces. And there wasn't quite as much traffic, but other than that, I was in an urban place.
Right.
I was in an urban place, and I was a little disappointed. You know, I wanted to see some giraffes and elephants and stuff. Don't they keep those right by the airport when you first get here?
Well, the development kind of scared them off.
Yeah. So anyway, to fast forward a little bit, after about 48 hours of being there, I first got to meet Alex Smith. He had been away the day I arrived. And we ended up spending a great deal of time in my hotel room and just hanging out. We would order room service, a couple of beers every hour or so. Sometimes we'd order two or three so they didn't have to keep coming back. But in this one long conversation about the second day I was there, basically Alex Smith gave me the history of Rhodesia from his perspective. Now, his perspective of being born in that country and, you know, his father being the prime minister.
The resource, I would say.
Yeah. And it was a fascinating tale. And he obviously, truly, deeply loved his country and wanted to be a part of it. Now, I should say that growing up as a Southern Baptist, some people will relate to this idiom. Alec was a classic preacher's kid.
Oh.
The preacher's kid in the Baptist and the Southern Baptist group is usually the worst kid in the whole church congregation. Well, that was kind of Alex.
And what denomination was he? Do you recall?
I have no idea.
Just wondering the Dutch Reform or something.
He went to college in South Africa. He went to Rhodes University there. And, you know, being the kind of sort of rebel from his father's conservative political position, he felt it important to set up a group there for the Students for Democratic Society at Rhodes University, which wasn't too appealing to the local government officials.
I can imagine,
They didn't like that too much.
He actually pulled that off?
Yes.
Wow.
Yeah, he created that organization. Don't know how long he was involved in it. But anyway, he got busted a couple of times for pot, you know, and it was to the point where the country of South Africa told him, you know, you make any infraction and you won't be allowed back in this country ever again. So he kind of cleaned up his act a little bit. And at some point, he became a converted Christian, and it really changed his life. I mean, he's one of those people that when he made that change in his late 20s, it changed him forever.
He took it on with conviction.
And it was now a part of his life. But in the process of growing up as this preacher's kid, you know, doing things that dad doesn't necessarily appreciate, one of the things that he did is he just left home and moved into one of the tribal trust lands in what was known as Mashona land. And as a result, he lived there at least for 6 months, became fluent in the Shona language.
Hmm.
And subsequent to that, went to the trouble to also become fluent in the Ndebele language.
My goodness.
And as a result, could communicate quite fluently with both the representatives of the Mashona interest and the Ndebele interest in the country, and lived in the prime minister's residence, you know, so had his father's ear whenever that was, a significant and important thing. And so as it evolved, when it became clear to the Rhodesians that they weren't going to succeed in keeping the country strictly under white rule, that it was going to have to be one man, one vote, and that this was just something that they had to accept, they began to negotiate with both the representatives from the Mashona and the representatives from the Ndebele. And getting back to this long conversation that Alec and I had, he gave me this whole history of the country, and it's really interesting geographically. Zimbabwe is, if you think of it roughly as a triangle, on the sort of northwestern side of the country, the Zambezi River mm-hmm. forms, and its valley forms a kind of a natural border, and on the
amazing river.
And on the south part of the country, the Limpopo River right. forms the southern border. And then on the eastern part of the country is the African escarpment. And the typical person, unless you've been to some place like this, really, at least certainly for me, I had no idea. Escarpment, what's that? You know, it's a big hill. Well, when I was standing there at this lookout at a little town called Umtali, which is right on the border of Mozambique, and where the guardrail was, you know, on the edge of this view spot, I could look down 2,000 feet.
My God.
And 2,000 feet below me was the country of Mozambique.
It's what we call God's eye view.
Yeah. Yeah, it was incredible. So anyway, he had told me how that for at least 1,000 years, the Mashona people had been the only people in what we know as Zimbabwe. And they were a very peaceful people. It was a very easy life for them in terms of being hunter-gatherers. And there was no really strong sort of military sense. They didn't compete mm-hmm. a lot amongst themselves. And if you think of the Mashona people as connected by their language, the Mashona language, it includes what is today Zimbabwe, most of Mozambique, and moves up into a beautiful country called Malawi. One of the things that I want to do before my life is over is I want to visit Malawi.
Mm.
Just absolutely fascinating concept. It's basically a 125-mile long lake that's where the crack in the African escarpment has opened up. So it's, you know, 1,000 feet deep in places.
Ooh.
And the country, Malawi, basically rims the lake and is about 50 miles wide on each side. And so the lake is really what the country is all about.
So it's developed pretty close to the water as well, I would imagine.
Yeah.
Do they live on that lake? Is that the area where they live actually? On the lake, a lot of the houses built on like wooden
stilts. Is that what you're thinking?
Yeah. I don't know the answer to that. That's yeah. I want to visit there and find out.
I would imagine
the
some
answer
of that does
that
exist
question.
In certain regions where the river is not prone to swelling and really.
I've seen the pictures in a book on Africa that I've looked at, but I can't remember if it was there or somewhere else in Central Africa.
But one of the interesting things that came out of this conversation with Alec as he related this history to me. Is the Indibili people had come to Mashona land mm-hmm. from South Africa. The Indibili were actually a Zulu tribe, and under the rule of Shaka, the Zulu
yes.
Emperor, that was very much a culture that lived off of warfare and gathering. Food and other material things.
Zulus were known for being great warriors.
Right, right. Yeah. And so anyway, the Indibili people at some point in time failed to pay a proper tribute to Shaka. And apparently, I mean, who knows what the deep backstory is, but the outcome of it was that Shaka decreed that the Indibili were to be eliminated, that total genocide, we're removing that entire tribe. It's not going to be a Zulu tribe anymore. Hmm. And so they were faced with, you know, trying to face the other six or seven tribes that, you know, they were now outcasts, or going north through the Limpopo River into Mashona land. The problem with that was in those days, and this is about 180 years ago, at that particular moment in time, because of diseases and everything else, if you took a group of people, say 1,000 people, through the Limpopo River Valley and came up on the other side, by the time, you know, 6 months had passed, about 80% of your party would be gone due to yellow fever
because of
malaria.
And all the regions they went through from swampland to God knows what. Yeah.
And so on. But he made the decision to do that, and his people followed it. It was a better option than just, like, not being anymore.
Mm-hmm.
And so they arrived in Mashonaland, and being Zulus and everything else, it was really easy for them to take over. And so they settled in an area today known as Bulawayo, and went forward. And so here comes Cecil Rhodes with a document from the Queen that allows him to take over certain parts of Africa in the interest of Great Britain. And he arrives in Mashonaland, and the first place they get is Bulawayo, and explains to the Indibili chieftain, you know, what he's there for, and et cetera. And the guy says, well, we have no problem with that. You can have Mashonaland. So this tribe who has been in Mashonaland for about 30 or 40 years gives Mashonaland to Cecil Rhodes,
yes.
And
the man behind Rhodesia.
Hence the beginning of the country of Rhodesia. Well, Alex's point in telling me all this, and he said something I thought was really interesting. He says, if you very carefully examine all of the conflicts that are going on in various countries around the world, and keep in mind this is 1978, for instance, various parts of the Middle East and various parts of the Indian subcontinent, et cetera, or even some parts of Europe, if Bosnia would be a good example of that. He said, if you look very closely, what you'll find is it appears today in 20th century literature, and it's represented as ideological differences. But it's not. It's tribes. It's tribal differences. These conflicts have existed for thousands of years.
I'm not surprised,
between these tribes, and they continue to go on. And if we can approach these problems from that perspective, we can go a lot farther than if we just deal with the ideological part that's pasted on top
of that. Yeah. Yeah, that's always been my view on Africa, that so many approaches have been so wrong because people, especially from the Western cultures, refuse to acknowledge that there are tribal differences that are not going to wash away in a melting pot concept, and that you do need to go a little more native before you think you know what you're doing over there.
Mm-hmm. And indeed, do we not have that going on in the Middle East today?
Absolutely.
I was hearing the same, when you were talking, I was thinking the same parallels with a more aggressive Israel population that came, and the English and Americans said, oh, why don't you settle here? Just like you were saying, that, you know, of course, the Jews had been there previously, but still the Palestinians were there, and they were a little bit more, I think at that time, not as aggressive.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And the Jews coming from Eastern Europe and being slaughtered had became aggressive. And that tension, it was very similar parallels. I can think of the Navajos and the Hopis in America that was similar. The Navajos were more aggressive, warlike, and they came into the Hopi area. The Hopis say they were there from the beginning of time. And they kind of took over, you know. You could see that parallel in many places.
There's also the big question of the Western government in as much as being able to deal with these tribes instead of dealing with them and granting them things they had rights to, we just massacred them.
Yeah.
That's pretty much been the government approach, it seems. And I don't think it's diminished by much.
Yeah.
So, before we continue with that story, I want to get a little more into your personal profile. Do you mind just revealing to us what your background in film and so on is? And then we can always jump back to this. And before we even go there, I want to say welcome back, Alex. He just got back from Cozumel. Alex is with Different Drum. And I'm actually going to twist his arm and get him involved with Seafarers. That's one of the things we're going to talk about later on today.
I'd love to do that, yeah.
But just wanted to welcome. He's back from Cozumel and on his way to Belize.
Well,
I want to be in this guy's luggage.
No, that Carborough was between Cozumel and Belize.
Boy, there's a wormhole somewhere.
I know a shortcut.
That's it.
Excellent.
And you can get there on a moped. Fancy that. Anyway, Michael, back to you. I would love to just sort of dig into your background, your credentials, and then go back to the story with Mandela and so on.
Well, as a young man, I grew up a mile from what is known as the Hobby Airport in Houston, Texas. At that time, it was the Houston International Airport.
Mm-hmm.
And in the 50s, as family entertainment, there wasn't really that much on our black and white TV every evening in the summertime. And we would go, and there was a viewing spot set up at the end of the runway. And I would watch these Lockheed Constellations come in. They were the effectively the ultimate transportation. They were the Concords mm-hmm. of the 50s. You know, they flew faster than any of the other airliners and big four-engine planes and all the other aircraft that came and went. And so, you know, my father died when I was 2 years old. He was a veteran of the Pacific War and died from his injuries in the war.
Sorry.
So he wasn't there. But everybody in my family would always tell me, you know, your father always wanted to be a pilot. He didn't have good enough eyes, but he always wanted to be a pilot. He had injured his eyes as a child. And so I was kind of programmed to be a pilot, you know. And it's mm-hmm. like, okay, that's something I'm going to have to do. And so when I got into college, I was extremely interested in writing by that time. In high school, I really fell in love with William Faulkner. And
good one to pick.
And, I really wanted to write. It's like this was something that was really important to me. And then I took a kind of a special seminar in humanities, and I thought, wow, you know, this covers the whole spectrum of art. This is great. And by the way, I should mention my mother was an oil painter. Wow. She specialized in doing portraits. Her full-time day job was a registered nurse, and raised my sister and I as you know, a single mom with two kids. But anyway, she, you know, I grew up listening to Tchaikovsky and Beethoven in my crib, and so I was always exposed to this kind of culture beyond just the normal everyday. But at some point in time, you know, I went to this humanities thing. So when I actually started to sign up for classes,
mm-hmm.
I was going to major in humanities, and I had this roommate that I should mention that I went to Oral Roberts University. I went there the second year that they accepted classes, so I was in the second class that was there, and I was at that time a very conservative Christian in terms of my beliefs, et cetera, and the way I conducted myself in, mm-hmm. in general public, et cetera. And here's this guy in my roommate. When I first walked into the room, he had moved in ahead of me. And here's this electric guitar and this stack of rock and roll records and stuff. And not that I had any problem with rock and roll or guitars or anything, but it was just not what I expected for my roommate to be. Well, it mm-hmm. turned out he was the wild child of the campus. You know, before it was all over, you know, they set him down one day and said, you know what, we really think it would be better if you found another college to go to.
No.
We're not going to throw you out, but, you know, maybe this isn't exactly where you should be. But anyway, he was a big influence on my life, as friends always are. And
in the creative sense, or in the sense of being a bit of a rebel? Or
in giving me a new perspective.
Opening you up.
He grew up in Florida. You know, he grew up 3 miles from the beach.
Right.
And, you know, so he had a completely different perspective on many things mm-hmm. than I did. And so anyway, we're standing in line to sign up for classes, and he says, well, what are you going to major in? And I said, humanities. And he looks at me, and he says, well, where's the money in that? And it's like I looked at him, and it's like, well, I hadn't really thought about that. You know, what do you do
with
humanities?
There's no money in being nice to people.
What do you do with a degree in humanities? And I started thinking, well, you know, you could teach, and you know, is that what I want to do? And I'm looking through the catalog, and here's this this major called Radio and Television Communication.
Mm-hmm.
I thought, well, that sounds interesting. I'll do that. That's what I'll sign up for.
Oh, such things as destiny made.
Yes.
Yeah. You know, in the period of 60 seconds standing in line to enroll for classes.
The wormhole found him.
Yes.
fast forward 2 years later, and I needed to take an elective course. And for the first time in the college, they were offering a course that was part of my major that was introduction to film. Mm-hmm. And I thought, well, I'll take that course. And by now, I've done several projects where I've directed two camera shoots in our studio, and I've got a board shift on the college radio station. And so I've gotten my feet wet with doing some creative development of projects and stuff like that. And I get into his class, and my teacher was one of those teachers that you meet in life that changes everything for you. And he was a multiple award-winning director of photography, a filmmaker. And in those days, we didn't have video. I mean, right. There was no portable video. If you wanted to take video and shoot it somewhere on location, you needed a couple of tractor-trailer trucks.
You know, I can imagine.
Compared to my little HD camera that I have here today that's the size of two cigarette packages.
Mm-hmm.
But anyway, I took this film course, and Dan Dunkelberger was his name, and you can probably look him up on Internet Movie Database and find some interesting credits for him. But he imbued in me this passion for photography, for being a filmmaker, and I was already shooting some things with my little 8mm camera. Forget Super 8. This was 8mm.
I remember those.
So, you know, I had some interest in photography, et cetera, but he would always talk about, you know, the joys of, you know, using the camera and telling a story with the camera, et cetera. And about that same time, the movie Lawrence of Arabia came out.
That was a big epic.
And I was already a big fan of David Lean. I loved Lawrence of Arabia. I loved Dr. Zhivago.
I was going to say, did Lawrence predate Dr. Zhivago?
It did, okay. Indeed. So it may have been a little bit earlier. But I remember watching that movie, especially the opening sequence where it's establishing his locale in Africa, mm-hmm. and all these beautiful scenes of the desert and the dunes and all that. And that camera work in that particular movie and that particular sequence is probably some of the best camera work that was ever done.
I agree. The only thing I think that is compared to that at all on any significant level would be the English Patient,
mm-hmm.
the opening of that, which was incredible
right.
as well.
But right. Yeah. So, you know, at that moment in time, I remember sitting in the theater and watching that movie and telling myself, I want to be the guy on the other end of that camera looking through this lens. And that was kind of what launched me from there. I continued to, you know, work on my my degree program. And along the way, I took flying lessons and ultimately became a commercial pilot. And
I didn't know that about you.
And
I was wondering when you were going to get to that part.
And I earned my flight instructor certificate. And at this point, I was considering, where do I want to go with my career? Do I want to become a professional pilot? Do I want to fly airliners?
Actually, I was going to ask when you had to land the thing in the water and become a sailor. He's a sailor too, folks. Back to you.
But anyway, so I was taking the flying lessons while going to school and so on. So I finally ended up being in a little bit of a financial crunch and needing to get a job. And I thought, well, I'm going to take advantage of, you know, by then I already had a third class radio telephone mm-hmm. operator's license, so I could mm-hmm. I could work a board shift at a radio station. So I just went and applied at all the local radio stations and all the local TV stations and got two jobs in 48 hours.
Not bad. Wow.
A radio station put me on as the guy who came in on Saturday morning from 6 a.m. to noon and the guy that came in on Sunday night from midnight to 6 a.m.
It was a pretty long shift.
It was a challenge, that especially that midnight to 6, trying to stay awake and we had a programmed music library where we played exactly the same song. It was basically we were broadcasting elevator music,
mm-hmm.
and so it wasn't terribly exciting.
All the more difficult to stay awake by.
But it was good. It was in my career field, and I was getting paid. And at the same time, I got a part-time job working almost 40 hours a week at the local CBS affiliate as a floor crew cameraman. So here I was, entry-level floor crew camera guy, and making literally minimum wage. And I continued to work for the TV station for a total of 3 years. And along the way, just harassed the management until they moved me into news, because in news, we actually got to shoot film.
Mm-hmm.
And that was really what I wanted to do.
Here comes the camera.
And finally, after a year and a half, they said, okay, Corbett, we'll move you into the news. And so for a little over a year, I worked as what we called a news photographer there at KOTV Channel 6. And covered a lot of stories, and sometimes I would go out as a one-man band where I would have my sound camera, and I would set up the camera and frame up the shot, and then I would interview the person. Because, again, being the new guy and the low one on the totem pole, I got the Saturday and Sunday shifts.
Right.
So I would get to go out and interview the obscure politician and be the one-man band.
In the interest of catching more of your biography,
sure,
because we've got about 25 minutes left, mm-hmm. Why don't we sort of jump around a bit to bring your profile more to date?
Okay.
And I'm not trying to stop you from telling your story.
No,
it's fascinating,
no,
but
no.
I just looked at the clock and I realized we're down to 25 minutes.
Yeah, and I was trying to basically set the whole background for this film passion thing. And so... as the news photojournalist, and this was really where it all really started to come together, I would shoot about 1,200 feet a day, 16-millimeter film. Again, we had no videotape.
Right.
And so we would go out and shoot our assignments. On a typical day, I would have one sound assignment, and I would have one or two non-sound assignments. And the non-sound assignments I shot with my little spring-wound, wind-up Bell & Howell DH-70 16-millimeter camera with a turret with three different lenses on it. And then the sound things we would shoot with a camera called an Oricon. It had been converted from optical sound to magnetic sound. But the point is I would shoot 1,200 feet a day. And when I made that move from floor crew cameraman to the news department, this is one of the stories I love to tell my students as something to kind of hang your career on. I went to one of my favorite people at the TV station, who was the noon news guy, and then he would also go out, the anchor on the noon news, and he would go out and cover stories in the afternoon as a reporter. But I went to Mike Flynn, and I asked him, I said, Mike, I want to become the best news photojournalist in Tulsa, Oklahoma. What do I do?
Mm-hmm.
And he said, well, Michael, that's really easy. You read Benjamin Franklin's autobiography. And I would love to have a picture of my face when he said that to me. It's like, you know,
ain't
what?
That guy from Philly?
What? You know, how is, you know, this guy who lived 175 years ago going to help me be a news photojournalist? And he said, I tell you what, I'll make it easy. Don't even bother to read the book. Just keep a journal of everything you do every day. Make a record of how you do it. Review it. Every day, review it once a week for, you know, past weeks, review it once a month for and learn from it. Well, I took him literally. We had a little cubby there in the TV station, and I had a spiral binder, and I took notes in it and kept track of what f-stops I shot at, mm-hmm. and for a particular story, did I get the focus right, and, you know, did I use the right lenses, and was the exposure
all
proper?
All the details, yes.
And so after a while, you begin to go to the same places over and over again. And I began to observe, you know, that, well, the same thing holds true every time in this place and so on. And so it happened that our processor that processed our film had an issue. And I won't get into the whole backstory of that. But the bottom line is I came in on a Monday morning and went out and shot. And everything I brought back that day... was overexposed by a stop and a half.
Ouch.
It was still usable, but it was clearly overexposed. It was ugly film. Well, so was everybody else's. And so that immediately told me the problems with the processor. I mean, this isn't a middle giant. The head cameraman guy who had actually rebuilt the processor on Sunday said, oh, no, it's not the processor. I just rebuilt it. So his solution was he went out and bought all six of us camera guys brand new light meters. Well, I was thrilled to have a brand new light meter. I mean, this was great. This was, you know, a big upgrade from what I was using before, and although I knew that wasn't the problem. So on Tuesday, I went out, and everything I shot, because I knew nothing else had changed, I stopped down a stop and a half, more than I normally would. And when I came back to the station that night and we processed my film, everything I shot that day was a stop and a half overexposed. So that means that it was actually overprocessing the film by 3 f-stops.
My word.
So the third day, I'm now stopping down 3 f-stops, everything I shoot. I come back in. Everything I shot that day was not only a stop and a half overexposed, but there wasn't any color left. It was kind of like black and white gray things moving around on the screen. But of the 6 cameramen in the news department, I was the only one who brought back anything that could be put on the air that day.
Jeepers.
So the outcome of all that was the news director took me aside with the chief cameraman and said, "Corbett, what's going on? Why are you getting something that we can use and nobody else can?" And I said, "Well, it's really easy. The processor's broken." And, of course, the chief cameraman, "No, it's not. I rebuilt it on Sunday, blah, blah, blah." And so I got out my little chart, and I showed him. This is what I normally shoot at this place. This is what I shot at it today. This is what I normally shoot at this, and so on, and kind of proved my case. Well, so he rebuilt the processor and sure enough found that 2 tubes had been crossed and the developer tube was going into the bleach tube and so on and so forth. But what it did to my career was they gave me my own department at that time. They moved me out of the news department. I became the one-man department. And now instead of, you know, from my perspective, my inferior Oricon conversion and Bell & Howell DR70, I was now in the big times. I had an Arri 16BL camera, and I had a 16S, and I had a Nagra recorder. I had an editing system, and I was walking in tall cotton.
Not bad. Now give us some of these the highlights of these extraordinary things that you've pulled off. I want to make sure we get those while we still have the hour.
All right. Fast forwarding.
Yes, indeed.
I eventually moved to Florida to get away from making television commercials. I had kind of gotten burned out on doing that in Tulsa, Oklahoma. I had my own production company. And for a while, my wife and I didn't have any children at that point. By the way, we've been married 32 years.
We're one of those congratulations.
Couples that figured out how to make that work. Just be polite to one another and really care.
Marvelous idea.
But anyway, after about a 2-year sabbatical from filmmaking, where I basically just went fishing as often as I could and did a few other things, we lived off our savings pretty much for a little over a year.
Where in Florida were you?
We were in Naples, Florida.
I'm going to interrupt for a brief moment just to let everybody out there know this is Claudio Speakeasy and Radio Theater here in the studio with my co-host Audrey Layden. Also have my friend Alex Weiss of Different Drum, and we are interviewing Michael Corbett, cinematographer, and so much more. Back to you, Michael.
So anyway, it just so happened that I had developed a rapport with the owner of the largest rental equipment firm in really the Southeast United States. His name is Egon Stefan, and he owned a company called Cine Videotech. His son now owns it. Egon has passed on. But basically, Egon put me to work, working in his rental house with the understanding, and this is a very common practice in rental houses, that I could go out on jobs with his equipment. And it's a win-win because I got to get paid crew rates at that point instead of my regular hourly rate by him. And he knew I was looking after his equipment.
Right.
And so and this happens with equipment rental companies all over the country. This is a very common practice in the film industry. But he told me when I first started doing this, he said, "Look, at the end of 2 years, you'll be able to do whatever you want to with your film career. You will meet so many people. You'll get to network, assuming you do a good job," and so forth. And 3 years later, I wrote him a letter and reminded him of that conversation and thanked him for what he had done, because at that particular moment, I was finishing my first feature film as the unit production manager and assistant director, and a million-dollar feature film that was independent feature film shot there in Miami. So
what was that? Do you remember?
It was called The Victims. Never made it into the theater. There's a whole long story. Wow. Someday I'm going to do a tell-all book. I'm not ready to do a tell-all book yet, because even if I did it, I would use a nom de plume and change the name to protect the guilty. But,
and move to South America.
But people would figure out who I was before too long. And so I when I get into my 80s and don't care anymore, maybe I'll do
move to Belize. Alex can drop in.
There you go. But anyway, once I got to Miami, that's kind of like when my career really took off. I worked on a number of different feature films, worked on lots of television commercials.
You were even involved with Miami Vice there.
I did get to work as a day player, as I call it, as a grip and electrician on Miami Vice. And a lot of times my students, when they first come to me, they'll kind of like, grip electric, I want to be a director. By the way, I've never had a student in 20 years that didn't want to be a director. Doesn't matter where they go.
Is that where the ego centers?
I guess, the directors are the ultimate, auteurs of productions. But I personally love being a grip. Probably the most fun I ever had working as a grip was on a movie called Cat Chaser with Peter Weller and Kelly McGillis.
It's one I've yet to see. I don't think I've seen it.
And what exactly does a grip do?
I love that question. They're the guys that go up ladders at the beginning of the day, and you don't see them until they call rap when they come back down. That's a joke from the McKenzie Brothers, if you ever heard their comedy album back in the 70s, I guess. The grips are the engineers of the film set. They are the ones that build the rigs that the camera goes on, or they build the rigs that the lights get hung from. If you need to put a camera on a helicopter or a boat or a car, a grip will do it.
In many ways, the techies, like on stage.
Right. They're also responsible for the safety associated with the camera. The key grip can step up at any time and say, this is not safe, we've got to change this. Mm-hmm. And that's a respected part of the industry. But one of my favorite things, I got to do this on Cat Chaser. Tony Richmond was the director of photography of that project. And if you look on the Internet Movie Database, he's got credits to die for as a director of photography. But at one point he came to me, we were doing this shot where I had to mount the camera in the car, and he says, where can I put it? Where can I put the camera? And I said, anywhere you want to, sir. And he gave me this look, and he says, well, what if I want to put it over here? And I said, well, that'll take about half an hour, 45 minutes to set up. Well, what if I want to put it over here? Well, that would take a little longer. It might take me 2 hours to get the camera there for you, but, we can do that. He said, well, what if I want to put it right here? And where you wanted to put it was like in a window looking across Peter Weller so we could see Kelly McGillis sitting in the passenger seat. And I said, well, I can have that done in 30 minutes. And he looked at his watch. He said, okay, I'm going to time you. And he walked away. So 25 minutes later, I went over and found him on set and said, okay, you want to come look at your setup here on this this car mount rig. He and I became very close friends by the time that show was over. He's a British director of photography, and in Britain, unlike the United States, the grips are actually part of the camera department. In the United States, they're a distinct department onto themselves. Mm-hmm. So he was just accustomed to working very closely with this key grip. So we got to have a lot of fun playing together.
That sounds great. Is there anything that you want to give us a bit of a synopsis? And I'm only saying this in the interest because we've got about 8 or 10 more minutes. Give us a rundown on your career, the things that your accomplishments, essentially, if you don't mind me.
And what you're doing now.
Well, I was going to say, for the last 10 years, I just celebrated my 10th anniversary, January 2nd, of working at Piedmont Community College.
Congratulations.
I was recruited here from Orlando, Florida at Valencia Community College, where I was the first director of the film program there. I was part of the whole pilot project that was funded by the federal government for Valencia Community College in Orlando, Florida, to develop a curriculum for teaching technical filmmaking. Mm. And the distinction I'm making, most film schools teach people to be directors or other above-the-line personnel, actors, producers, production right. designers, etc. The whole purpose of this community college program in Orlando was to teach technicians to provide technical individuals who could work at Universal Studios and Disney MGM Studios. This was all based on the fact that the state of Florida had sponsored a third-party survey of producers and directors from both New York and L.A., and the survey, in essence, wanted to know, what do we have to do in Florida to get you to come here to make your pictures? And this was before the whole film incentive thing started happening with all the different states. So everybody was kind of on a level playing field in that regard. And the overwhelming answer from the producers was, have a skilled base of technicians that can work on our shows so we don't have to bring our crews from L.A. or New York.
Makes good
sense. And so that was what then sponsored the legislature of Florida to fund this research grant to develop the curriculum for the film program. So the film program we have at Valencia, at Piedmont Community College in Yanceyville, is a clone of the one in Orlando. And the focus is on training our students to have technical skills. They can leave our program with their Associate of Science degree and walk on the set of a feature film production and go to work as a grip or an electrician or a camera assistant or a boom man or an editing assistant and be right at home and do a great job.
So immerse them in the basics, basically.
So to summarize what's happening to me now is, after 10 years of being a part of that program, I've had the privilege of seeing it grow and develop. It was originally created to provide workforce for Carolina Pinnacle Studios, which is a 300-acre studio complex located in Yanceyville, North Carolina. Sadly, the studio has gone bankrupt three times now in the last 16 years and is presently bankrupt. Our program has thrived.
Fantastic.
Our program has thrived. So even though we're out of the way, our students have to drive to get there. Many of our students come from this area.
How far is that from here, Yanceyville?
It's about just over an hour's drive.
All right.
Is it north of Greenville? Where is Yanceyville?
It's north of Greensboro.
We're
literally 50.
I was there. I did a festival there in September.
Mm-hmm.
Little festival. Maybe you were filming.
Yeah. We probably were.
It was on the street. It was a rainy, dreary day.
I was going to say, it was raining that day.
You know that festival?
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
We played around.
The Bright Leaf Hoedown.
He was the homeless-looking guy with a jumbe.
There you go. But in my 10 years, this is what I'm most proud of. In my 10 years at Piedmont Community College, I have seen the film program there go from being, you know, in a small little noisy room in the K building on the Yanceyville campus, the Caswell County campus. And at that time, we owned a film camera and a nice video camera, a Beta SP video camera, a 15-passenger van, and a 16-foot trailer. And that was the whole package that I walked into. And the first class that I taught there, the very first week in January of classes of 2000, six students showed up.
Oh, my goodness.
And I was on a temporary contract. My contract only ran through the end of May.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm thinking, boy, this isn't going to last. I'm going to have to do something here. And so anyway, I was able to, in the intervening 10 years, we now have a $2 million infrastructure on the campus of Piedmont Community College. We have a $1.5 million building that was built from the ground up specifically for animation and film. So our laboratories are custom designed for that. We have a lighting laboratory that's about 3,000 square feet, 2,000 amps of electricity, et cetera. Our equipment package is a full feature film equipment package. Now, obviously, you can get a lot more than what we have, but I have worked on independent feature films with less equipment than we own.
Wow.
We have our own 5-ton grip truck. We have our own 500-amp generator. Our largest lighting unit is 12,000 watts. It takes 180 amps just to operate it. So, I mean, if we went to shoot at somebody's house, we'd have to plug into two houses in order to get it to work. So we bring our own generator. So I'm extremely proud of the legacy I think of that I have created there with the PCC film program.
And obviously you still freelance out to get involved in other independent film projects, which is how I met you.
Very rarely.
In fact, I can fully understand that.
In the last 10 years, I have actually only worked outside of my regular job on two occasions. Both times were on feature film type projects, or like this pilot projects. And both times were within the last year. And my goal in both of those situations wasn't particularly to make money, but it was to network and meet more people that I could then turn my students on to.
Certainly, yeah.
My whole focus with our students is there have been about 10 feature films produced in the Piedmont Triad region, you know, Greensboro being kind of in the heart of all that. Parenthetically, I am on the Piedmont Triad Film Commission, so I'm involved in trying to...
By the way, is that a website? Do you have a website where people can look up your background or find out about you or your teachings in Yanceyville and so on?
Well, pccfilm.com, okay. pccfilm.com is the website for the program. But anyway, in the last, you know, 5 years or so, 10 feature films... On those feature films, 20 to 50% of the crew of those feature films have been graduates from our program.
Incredible.
So that
Bravo.
Is probably that's the thing I'm wow. most proud of, yeah. is Bravo. Our graduates are going out and finding work in the industry. They're working as technicians, and they're loving it. Now, some of them are going beyond that. Our most successful graduate, Matthew B. Moore, has his own production company and is producing independent feature films. So... I guess that kind of summarizes...
Good things springing forth.
The latest stuff. The other thing I would say is we have made 35 projects in the last 10 years. Four of them were feature films in length. The rest were shorter, as short as 5 minutes.
Mm-hmm.
We've won 35 awards.
Incredible.
For our project. Now, all the projects didn't win awards, some won more. But the point is we teach to a very high bar.
Sounds like it. And I take my hat off to you in that regard.
Thank you.
I want to thank you for being on. And Michael, since I don't think we got into nearly enough about your life, and I apologize to everyone out there that we never made it back to Africa. Time just sort of slipped away. I could have just leaned back in a chair and let you go on for a while, but I realized I had to look at the time factor. So my apologies for butting in when I did.
No problem.
But it's been a real genuine pleasure having you on board, and consider yourself part of the Speakeasy family at this point, and let's continue this.
Thank you.
Keep it going on.
Thank
I also at
much.
Some point want to involve you in Seafarers. Maybe work on a little bit of an art film concept somewhere down the road. I know we discussed that. But once again, really heartfelt Great. Thanks for being on. Alex, thank you for being on.
It was a pleasure.
Audrey,
Jeff.
Thank you for the wonderful assistance.
Yeah,
this is Claudio Speakeasy and Radio Theater, 103.5 FM, that's WCOM, signing off.